The first poem is called Clean. It's about my recovery from alcoholism and drug abuse. I've been clean and sober, thank God, for about 10 years. And this was written on the 6th anniversary of my getting sober. Clean. Today, 1/11/96, sober 6 years, and I say morning prayers without speaking. I make the coffee while my wife rises. I listen without weeping at a sad ballad. The sound of the snow on the roof is important. Important as fresh bread or the neighbor warming her car. Important as a plan or an empty chair. That's why this morning, 6 years later to the day, I hear the slight chimes of the Angelus bell, hear the ash settle in my fireplace, hear the beauty of my wife's sigh as she sits cross-legged on the edge of the bed and asks, half aware, why I'm alive at this hour. This poem is called Editing. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and this story is absolutely true, just as it is said. I dedicated this poem to a fellow named Dennis Lane, and I slightly exaggerate his voice. But nonetheless, it's an absolutely true story. Editing. This other non-vet comes to see me and wants me to see his manuscript. He brings this nosh, some bagels, so I say, okay, let's see it. Yeah, okay, I'll read it. So we got some time till later, so we swap some nom stories. He says, this is what's pitiful, man. I'm visiting Jim Mills, this fuck-up all wounded, you see. It's this hospital, the Trang. From a distance, it's all this commotion, but so what? It's Nam. I got directions to Jim Mills, and I got to pass this commotion. I start up some stairs, begin to look a little into this second floor, when halfway up the flight, I see nothing but running feet and screams. Just running feet, some bunches of blood pools and some screams. I got to turn before I completely see in, and there's the nurse, all white right there at the door. I got to ask, hey, lady, what the hell? But she's just sitting at this desk. Imagine report writing at the door of the screams. So I look. I see the screams are a dozen guys. I can't tell black from who's white. And they're all running and banging walls and leaving whole body, I mean the full body on the wall, bloodstains. And they're naked, because all the napalm left was no skin, nothing, not even no boots. So I beg the nurse, do something. But she says, any more morphine and they'll die. Finally, I see she's just as freaked and fake and calm, and nobody knows what to do. So I go off on her when one guy runs up at my face, and he's just going, mama, 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 and like that. I always feel bad for that nurse because she's maybe 23 and in charge of a platoon of the dead or what's left. So I walk off, find some quiet, and just stuff my mouth with my fatigue shirt and scream till I can't stop. And when Jim Mills later asks, what's that back there, man? I say, you know how we used to say, don't mean nothing, man. It just don't mean nothing. This is called Prodigal. When I think of myself at 10 or 15, I think of Our Lady of Perpetual Help, her promises of mercy, which made me believe my faith would stop my father from drinking, my mother from screaming. So I'd light one more candle, say one more rosary, mark, bargain, one more deal with Jesus, promise, like my mother promised my father, you give me peace or I'll give you hell. Between 16 and 40, I lit no more candles, prayed no novenas, kept no promises except one, to be that angry bastard who abandons God. Hear me now, God. It took me decades to regain my faith, sanity, sobriety. Now my father's dead, my mother 88, and again for them I pray, except this time I make no promises. This is called The Child in White. A few years ago, a friend of mine's daughter was murdered, and I'll get to some love poems here in a little while. Not all of my poetry has people dying by the thousands, but these first ones just happened to. And his daughter was murdered, and I wrote him this poem. The Child in White, and it's dedicated CS 1978 to 1990 for her father. Ever since the war, something shrill sings along your nerves, messages like artillery coordinates in a code no one knows. Like the way lightning clears the air for thunder, there are many ways to practice death. Finding her body for one, half naked, the maniac still in the neighborhood, some guy you meet at the grocery. For days the sun touched her teeth. Not knowing how to stop, you remember her body dead, then alive, then dead again. The camera zooms in. The reporter gets some fine lines, but your vow of vengeance pleases her most. Who wouldn't grieve the child in white? Who wouldn't grieve as the prosecutor drags you before the 12 elders to recount the bruises on her neck, on her thighs? Who wouldn't grieve as night after night you strangle that bastard over and over and over until even his death isn't enough death for the life of your daughter? Now you too believe in the evidence of her azure lips, like all the other clues the major case squad missed. The blood on the leaves, the yellow frost, a fine ice. You bear them as any father would bear her empty room through the seasons until they too turn into a tender felon, a winter, finally, of forgiveness. There's a curious follow-up to this poem. I was teaching out at Lindenwood, and it turns out that one of the investigators on this case was in my class, and he liked the poem, and he put the poem into the file. At the time, I was very touched with that. By that, now I kind of wonder: is that a good idea? You know? Nonetheless, it was rather touching. This one is called Al-Bad. This is the poem I gave to my wife on the anniversary of our wedding night. It occurred to me like about 3 or 4 days before we got married that, you know, it's a tradition for poets to read a poem to their wife the day of their marriage. And like about 3 or 4 days before we got married, it occurred to me that my wife might know that tradition too. So I kind of got it together. I was kind of surprised. Al-Bad. Today, Phoebe, I begin a new poetry, a simple verse. I don't aspire to some grand fanfare one visits in white and advances amid chords of Mendelssohn's Wedding March. I will write a poem that begins right outside the house, a poem that begins in the evening and, like that path to the ancient gate, is a crazy quilt work of paving and moss. I don't want a poetry that journeys to Monte Carlo in a yacht. I want a poem that begins in your overgrown flower bed and ends in our daughter's old bike rusting in the garage. I want to write lines that begin in the fragrance of our freshly cut lawn and end in the flavor of water. I just want a song that begins in diminuendo and ends with the touch of your hand. I've been a school teacher for many years, and this poem is really, I guess, about that. In winter, the schoolmaster stares out his window. In the snow, the footprints lead. He forgets which way, in, out. Yesterday, his lover left. The kids want to know what's out there. God, it just dawns on me. I've been a teacher for about 25 years. What am I talking about? 10 years. That was 15 years ago. I was a teacher for 10 years. I think if I really was to assess my own writing, I'd say in some ways that I have a very poor imagination. And I tend more to record. I'm really a historian by training. And so I have a tendency more to simply record things than I do actually think things up. I really stand kind of astonished at people who can think up like whole new stories, you know. With me, it's really more an act of recording. And this was true. This is about my wife and how I knew I loved her one night. And this is how I knew I loved you. Something told me you were near, and suddenly the subtle sounds. I just knew the approach of your high heels behind me, that peculiar scratch of nylon thigh by nylon thigh. And I knew. I just knew. I live a very sort of middle-class life, and this poem was inspired one day when I was driving up, and I punched the garage door opener. I'm an old hippie in addition to being a Vietnam veteran. And, you know, my old hippie days, you know what I would have told you about people who had garage door openers? And suddenly I find that I am that person suddenly. And it's nice. You know, I mean, I realized, you know, there's a lot more wisdom to being middle class than I originally thought. And this poem is sort of dedicated to that idea. It's called The House Poet. I pull up, pull the brake, and wonder what brought me to this, my chores, my laundry, my garage. I never understood the word my unless it modified a periphery, my war, my liquor, my passport. And now I am here in this skin, and it is true, the word home modified by my, and it is no mistake, the grammar perfect, each word building the next, my street, my house, my wife. This is called When Magdalene Was the Good Time Gal. I've since found out that the myth of Mary Magdalene is really wrong. The myth of the prostitute who becomes a saint. It turns out that several scholars have told me since I wrote this that was later a very sexist stereotype of the woman who seemed to have actually in fact bankrolled the early Christian church. But I was glad I didn't know that when I wrote this. And I say this as a historian, sometimes, you know, when it comes to poetry, it helps to not know the truth. Because it can just really get in the way of some really nice lines. So I wrote this poem. It's called When Magdalene Was the Good Time Gal. Even now, some sneer as some guy at the bar, his wife far from mind, begins with, I remember she did this muscle trick, and laughs, and some other guy stares through the wall and over the roof and out into the desert where she kneels. And he remembers the last time she knelt before him, how she undid his robe. And he remembers suddenly not the sex, but the other man, that last man she knelt before, the only man who asked her to sin no more. This is called Break. It's actually the oldest poem in this collection. By the way, if any of you are interested in looking at the full collection, I left some stuff over here that has the URL, whatever that is, the address, the universal. Somebody help me out. The universal something location, the URL, at the Pittsburgh Quarterly online. It's called Break. During a break, you thought about how you got laid. in Mexico a little over a year ago. You sometimes try to remember that Mexican stare on the job during uneventful days. You become restless, sleepless with forgotten anticipation. It takes your mind off work. Only a schedule separates your Mexican and your thoughts of resisting your last damn good lay. But that lay remains, burns, makes you tremble with vague memories. This is called Suma. It just dawns on me. I got this poem about a saint. I got this poem about getting laid. And then now I got this poem about theology. And it's really true. Poetry is kind of a walk through my mind. You know, that's what I think about God, politics, and sex, and war, and, you know, peace. Summa. Dear theologian, I was just thinking teleologically when I remember my first lover fondly and feel guilty because I'm happy with my wife. It's all the gray that made me that way, the cold snap, the autumn, the fog. I remember some windows in York Minster, the five sisters, and wonder why, in an age of outrageous stained glass stories, somebody created the windows all gray. Yesterday, a neighbor moved to I don't know where. It made me sad all the same, the move, the gray, the thoughts of old sex in York Minster. This is why in the end I write in this simple black and white as if an infinity of black type might finally stop me from looking out the window and wondering where we're going. Lunch with mother. I hear somebody groan already. You know, having lunch with your mother can do that, can't it? Yeah. And this is one of those moments. Lunch with mother. For my part, I focus on her like one of those old films where everything is wavy except the speaker. Your father, my mother says, wanted you aborted. But I'm Catholic, so that's how you began, half chance, half prayer. Your grandmother agreed with your father because he was drinking, and you know how that goes. But he wanted you after you were born. He loved you. He was a good dad until he left when you were 10. You know, that's actually just like an actual recording of, you know. And, you know, what are you left with after that? You know, would you mind passing the salt, you know? Simplicity. Walking across the office, you recall the day you arrived, the air clear, millions of windows. Now you know the way it goes, the crowd, spare change. So there's no end to the indistinct mountains, the arts, crosswalks, nights you sit on the bed and watch a stream of traffic. Then once again, suddenly not quite depressed, you remember how different this is. The place names in Spanish, the lover who made you stay. And you, knowing the slope overgrown with tin roofs, no miles away, a man carving a mask stares straight at you. I probably should have mentioned I wrote that when I lived in Mexico City. I lived in Mexico City for about 5 years. About 4 years. I was there during the earthquake, so I guess that's what seemed like the extra year. This poem is the poem I'll mention that Michael mentioned, called Lament in D Minor. And it too is a true story, the opening paragraph or so, the opening stanza, I should say. I heard this story at a series of prayer vigils for people in Bosnia, and then I just heard this story. I immediately went home and wrote it. This is another one of those cases where I was glad I knew just a little bit, because then once I wrote it, people began telling me about this cellist, and I became so overwhelmed with facts and figures and this and that that it would have taken me years to write this poem if I had known any more than I did. It is actually in its other incarnation as a performance piece with a cellist playing Albinoni's Adagio in the background. Lament in D minor. On the side street outside a bakery every day for 22 days at 4 p.m. in May 1993, Vedran Smilovich, a cellist in the Sarajevo Symphony, played Albinoni's Adagio for his brother plus 22 others killed by a mortar shell. Today it's all silence, the place where the words must go, a whale's diminuendo to a gasp that never needs an explanation, that never knows another note, another measure. Like when there is only a hush with a single lyric string praying, this is the way we practice sorrow. This is the way we practice death. 22, 22, 22. The number ulcerates itself. As a breeze tersely testifies to the space between the pain and the adagio in the street, it makes us yearn for a definition of implosion. 22, 22. The number multiplies each lament. There was once a time for a theory of tragedy, how each crescendo culminates in the fado praying, how can we believe anything again? 22. Perhaps it means nothing, the number. Perhaps the sorrow we know today is only a prelude to the adagio we all call home, that place where all the brothers and all their friends are lined up against the wall, this wall that is the outline for our sorrow. Perhaps all sorrow is just a shell aimed at all our side streets where we are all lined up for some bread, a chat, a song of someone's brother, a song in which slowly, slowly we pray for another day, another road, another brother. For this we pray. I wrote a mass not long ago. And this, oh, by the way, I got to tell you a little story about this one. This was recorded in, the performance piece and was played in Zagreb. And during the recording, I mispronounced a word, and I was really worried about this, This kind of line here, as a breeze tersely testifies, and I mispronounced it. And, I was really worried about this. I really wanted to record it again. I think I mentioned, look, man, it's going to be translated in Serbo-Croatian. As long as if you read a menu from Duff's with meaning, that it would be fine. Nobody's going to know. And so, it made me feel really good. It made the cellist feel really good too, because it was a good take. This is from a mass I wrote not long ago. This is actually one of my most published poems. It gets published and republished. This mass I wrote has been published almost in it, not quite in its entirety, but in a lot of different places as individual poems. And this is called At My War's Wall, a Vietnam Requiem in which the veteran accepts the dead. Your resurrection destroys all our years of silence. Still, it happens. A hang round, Chi-Com grenade, an AK, maybe, RPG. These initials scribbled in that last after-action report. Your DD forms that slam closed that file like this, that silver casket. Now your name forms part of a wall, the final record, as if taps is static. As if my day's grown on now like some beast of burden drawing the plow through the paddy. The paddy has a name I remember no one knows now. No one remembers that my burden is a name, your name, simple as black granite. Hank, Pete, Greaser. No one speaks as we spoke of home then. A woman, a commune for dope-smoking non-vets, our clothes clean, our skin healed, our languor brutal, brutal and pure. I pause. I walk away. I am so alone with the wall that became your name. Let the ears do with us as they will. Let the birds of prey alight. Who can kill you? I will wear your name like a bracelet. I will make flutes from your bones. Two more poems. This one is called War Story, and it's a true story. War Story. After I got out of the NOM, I made up some tales, some mostly jokes. One time we're token, one time the horrors. Because nobody made any movies about how we're heroes. So now I'm told, you're a good guy, John. Welcome home, pal. So now I'll tell one last story. One night, on guard, I'm the new guy, so I decide I'd try my M79. Now, an M79 launches a grenade a little further than you can, hit a good home run. Slow, I aim for this field, figure range. Bingo, a good shoot. But the wind figures indifferent. A freak breeze drifts the hit into this village where it kills this kid. Except for the scream. That's the unadorned story. I'm going to read one last poem, a poem that I have a lot of fondness for, actually. It's called Passchendaele. This is a poem that is the longest poem in my collection, Morning Prayers. This one I really did research quite like a dissertation, if you will. I went to the library, read books on it, and so on. And I finally came across a diary of a fellow that was in the Battle of Passchendaele. This is really what it's based upon. I'm going to actually, for those of you who really aren't familiar with this bit of British or European history, I should say, read the author's note first, which gives kind of facts and figures, and then I'll dive right into the poem. Following the capture of Messines Ridge, the Battle of Passchendaele, also known as the Third Battle of Ypres, properly began on the 31st of July, 1917, with a British push toward the Belgian coast. After 4 years, the British penetrated a total of only 5 miles into the German lines, this endpoint being the village of Passchendaele. The Germans recaptured all this within 6 months. The British pronounced this place Passchendaele. And I'll use British pronunciations or, you know, slaughtered British pronunciations throughout this because, you know, I don't speak Flemish. The diary entry is taken from a Major C.A. Bill who fought with the 15th Battalion of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. And this is the diary entry. A party of A Company men passing up to the front found a man bogged to above the knees. The united efforts of four of them with rifles beneath his armpits made not the slightest impression, and to dig, even if shovels had been available, would be impossible, for there was no foothold. Duty compelled them to move up to the line, and when 2 days later they passed down that way, the wretched fellow was still there, but only his head was now visible, and he was raving mad. And the poem properly begins. A man raves against God, and war among its faces turns just one to you, the face which is your own, your own. It's not the kind of place that would worry you in the usual June, your uniform manly, your brass polished, sharp, so proud you would recite your unit's history as if it were a canto in its own Iliad. But that was 1914, when freedom was measured in the medals instead of the dead. To look at it, there isn't much of a ridge to speak of, 250 feet high, its only claim to fame being a splendid view of Flanders for which 544,897 die, maybe 4,700 a day, give or take a half a dozen divisions. What you have heard is true. 3:10 a.m., 7 June 1917, Messines Ridge. In preparation for the larger offensive, 1 million pounds of TNT detonated along 5 miles of galleries dug under the Germans. By 3:11 a.m., 20,000 dead. Survivors mindless, infantile, gibbering. The opening round. Then Passchendaele. A funeral cadence of muffled drums. Hill 60, the Death Trench, Blood Chapel, Ypres, White Sheet, Hill 70, Goldfish Chateau, the Blamertine Wipers Road, a map no larger than a mass card. Requiem, the litany of the dead angel of lead. 4,250,000 artillery shells fired during the first 19 days alone. Alone. A fact. And the fact of the matter is simple. God is not on your side tonight. And a man raves against God, earth, man. To think of you decomposing even as you speak. Humus once more a few pounds of ground, earth, the many faces of earth, one of which is the tomb, and the tomb is at once both earth and man. Like vertigo, you twist into the earth and beg the sun to blind you. Instead, a sunspot burns a hole in a vision you would kill if only you could. Hang on till your mind gets right. Who but a madman, who but a madman, who but a madman would have imagined mud enough to die in? Who but a madman would put guns in the hands of all God's children, tell them stories of glory, then kill them? Who but a madman would imagine Ypres salient? A man raves against God, and war among its faces turns just one to you, the face which is your own, your own. Your captain has his gas mask on, standing near the sniper's nest, advising the sergeant major never to show his face here again. Your sniper has no face, no mask. You too will learn to burn out your eyes, to take it like a man, to smother under mud, to go mad like a man. But what you thought was only darkness has its own kind of light, like being caught in a flare in which the only terror belongs to you, a German mortar crew with nothing better to do than take aim at you, just you, only you, there. Besides the madness, there's the woman. There's always the woman, delicate as a lie, clean and white, someone the mud doesn't touch, not someone who runs like the meaning of speech, but a woman, your woman, the one woman in the world who could save you, the one woman in the world you wish to die with. Adrenaline. The word burns the very marrow. In a moment no longer than a flare, in a time it takes a scream to reach sweet Jesus among 100 dead, another man trapped in mud, another man, then another sniper takes aim, another bullet goes astray and finds a home, the heart. And the bullet will burst like a mortar in the gut, and the gut will turn to lead, and the lead to the rain, always a slow assault of a rain, speechless as incest, shrapnel like a rapist, definite as barbed wire, permanent as the front. Always the past turns its face to ebony rain, and tomorrow will be just like today. Thank you.